Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Stop me if you've heard this one before, but did you know that Libya is going to be able to use its oil revenues to rebuild? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 29th of March today. The rebels in Libya have lost some of the ground they gained the past couple of days under cover of Allied airstrikes. Pro-Gaddafi fighters today pushed the rebels back from the town of Sirte. Away from the battle, meanwhile, as President Obama mentioned in his speech last night, there was a big Libya conference in London today. NATO countries, the United Nations, and representatives from more than 30 other governments got together to talk about the no-fly zone and what happens next. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
Now, this was, we should say, more of a political gathering, not so much about the money, right?
That's right. But there's always money there somewhere lurking in the background. It was, you're right, mainly political. It was about stiffening the coalition's resolve and planning for Libya's future, trying to avoid what the coalition partners feel was the big problem with Iraq, not enough forward thinking before the conflict. They talked about things like what to do with Gaddafi when they've ousted him. Should he be tried as a war criminal, or would it spare a lot of bloodshed and cost to persuade him to retire gracefully? So it was basically political. But there was some discussion of money. The Gulf state of Qatar confirmed that it will be selling Libya's oil on behalf of the rebels, and that money will fund the considerable humanitarian effort in Libya.
Well, as long as we're talking about money and funding, what about once the violence stops, once the military campaign is over and the cost of rebuilding comes into mind? Any discussion of that?
No, not at all. This is the great unmentionable. The assumption seems to be, I mean, first of all, on the military costs, that the coalition partners are going to shoulder their own military costs. And that, in the case of the US, by the way, is $550 million and rising. But the cost of reconstruction, the assumption, again, is that Libya will pay for its own reconstruction. It has, after all, one of the biggest reserves of oil and gas in Africa. Last year, it generated more than $30 billion in oil revenues for a country of only 6 million people. So the argument is Libya can easily afford its own reconstruction.
I want to make sure I heard that right, Stephen, because we were told the same thing about Iraq. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz said Iraqi oil will pay for its own reconstruction. Did anybody bring that up today?
No, but there is obviously a pretty widespread anxiety about this. Libya's oil output has clearly dwindled. Skilled foreign workers have fled. Some of the oil facilities have been damaged. It's going to be many months from the end of the conflict before that industry is producing sufficient revenues to rebuild Libya. Here's George Joffe, an expert on the Arab world at Cambridge University.
The damage done through neglect and now, of course, through military action is considerable, and it will take a long time to put it right. And somebody is going to have to pay in the short term. And I fear that is not going to be Libya.
And he says it's most likely to be the US and Europe. They are the richest participants in the coalition. And it does recall that warning from Colin Powell before the first Gulf War. Remember what he said? It's the rules of the China shop. If you break it, you own it. It may be very difficult for the US and Europe leading players in the military intervention to avoid picking up some, perhaps a lot, of the cost of rebuilding Libya.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London on the conference there about Libya today. Oil, by the way, about $104 a barrel, if you're counting. Stephen, thanks a lot.
Okay, Kai.
Oil, I just mentioned, in equities on Wall Street today. Slow start, stronger finish. Details, numbers, when we get there. Reports of a rebound in the housing market turn out to have been greatly exaggerated. According to a key housing indicator out this morning, that's the S&P Case-Shiller Index, Washington, D.C. was the only top 20 market in the country to see a rise in home prices last month, and even then, only a 10% increase. That news comes the same day that House Republicans announced their plan to shut down Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two government-owned mortgage companies that guarantee about two-thirds of all the new mortgages issued here. The basic idea of the House GOP is to get more private banks guaranteeing loans and so gradually minimize the role the government has to play. But the banks say, hold on just a second, got to make it worth our while. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Banks have stayed away from the loan guarantee game. It was easier to sell their loans to Fannie or Freddie and let them take the risk of guaranteeing mortgages. Now private banks are saying, if you want us to play the guarantee game, it'll cost you.
Consumers pay for everything.
Anthony Sanders teaches real estate finance at George Mason University. He says private banks would charge borrowers a higher fee to guarantee their loans than Fannie and Freddie did. It would be rolled into mortgages.
Loan guarantee fees would have to go up to at least 100 basis points. That's one full percentage point.
And the banks are likely to bump up interest rates a bit. They'll also demand bigger down payments. Guy Sakala publishes Inside Mortgage Finance. He says the higher bank fees could end up pushing buyers out of the market, at least temporarily.
Forcing first-time home buyers to wait until they can save up a down payment, forcing people with tarnished credit to improve their credit over a period of time.
Lawmakers do want the private market to step in here, but they also want to minimize the pain to home buyers. At one point, there were calls to kill off Fannie and Freddie. Now, says Karen Petru of Federal Financial Analytics, the view from Congress is
that Fannie and Freddie should be gradually wound down, not executed.
The idea is not to pull the welcome mat out from under home buyers' feet, just to make them save up more and pay a little more, so private banks will be more willing to guarantee their mortgages. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Amazon.com started as an online bookstore these many years ago. Now it sells basically anything you can think of ordering online, and lately the company has been signaling it wants to be even more, and especially it really wants to be like Apple. Last week, Amazon announced its own app store for smartphones that run on Google's Android platform. Today, it announced Cloud Drive. It'll let you upload your music to Amazon servers so you can then stream those tunes to any computer or Android phone anyplace. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports that Amazon is the first big player in what could be the next big thing.
Cloud computing has been widely hailed as the way we'll stay connected to our data in the future. Essentially, it's storing your music, personal videos, pictures, and other files in a remote locker of sorts that gives you access to what you want from just about anywhere. Now, when it comes to online music sales, Apple's iTunes remains king, but Amazon is hoping its offer of remote storage will be a game changer. Scott Stein is an associate editor at CNET. He says Amazon seems to be positioning itself to take on Apple as a one-stop shop, competing in the marketplace currently dominated by the iPhone and iPad.
They almost have everything but a tablet at this point. They have ebooks that a lot of people already use with the Kindle. They've already been able to sell MP3s online, but this really adds a cloud service for accessing that music. They even have an app store now. So really the only other provider out there that has that breadth of service is Apple.
Initially, Amazon is giving away 5 gigabytes of online music storage, enough for hundreds of songs. Buy an album from Amazon, like Britney Spears' latest, Femme Fatale. And Amazon will bump the space up to 20 gigabytes. As an added incentive, music purchase from Amazon doesn't count against that storage. Amazon's cloud player for streaming music works on Android-based devices, but not Apple's iPhone or iPad.
It's a great move for the Android platform, and I think it's a big win for them. I think a lot of people, when they see that, are going to want it on their other phones as well.
Stein expects both Apple and Google to launch their own cloud streaming services soon. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The Securities and Exchange Commission has been trying to get its hands on hedge funds for years now, bring them inside the regulated world that most other traders and markets have to live in. That hasn't worked out so well, so the SEC is trying something different. Regulators have now decided they're going to poke through the profits that hedge funds return to their clients. Rule of thumb is going to be that any fund that beats the market by more than 3% is fair game. We've got our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore on the line. Hey, Heidi.
Hi, Kai.
So why is the SEC looking into this now?
Two words, Bernie Madoff. So Bernie Madoff, as you know, had incredibly good returns the whole time that he was investing over decades. He only had three or four bad months. And of course, that's nearly impossible to accomplish. Someone who's honest probably won't do so well so regularly. Now, the problem is that the SEC can't really look into hedge funds. In fact, they have this relationship a little bit like what you saw in Seinfeld. Hello, Newman. It's always been somewhat combative. So right. The SEC may not have the manpower or the access to find out this information. They're going to have to check public databases just like everybody else.
And we should point out that's because hedge funds are largely unregulated, right?
Exactly. They have fought every attempt at regulation. And in fact, they don't even have to file their addresses with the SEC right now, although they will eventually.
All right. So hedge fund managers clearly not happy with the prospect of the SEC looking into their rate of return. But objectively, if you can, what's so wrong with it?
Well, the biggest problem is that hedge funds actually are supposed to beat the market a lot. So I asked a hedge fund manager, Eric Jackson at Ironfire Capital, what he thought.
If the bar is 3%, it just seems like such a low bar. A typical investor expects a 7% return in stocks. I think most investors going into hedge funds expect better.
So most investors think that Bernie Madoff was pretty unique, and profits or returns are sacrosanct to hedge fund managers. They don't want anyone looking too closely. They'd prefer the SEC to just answer the calls that come into their office, the complaints, and they think that's the better way to find wrongdoers.
Yeah, of course they do. I mean, that kind of makes sense if you're a hedge fund manager. But draw the larger lesson for me. What is this? First of all, the fact that the SEC is looking into it and then the hedge fund's reaction. What does that tell us about the larger hedge fund industry?
Well, it tells us that hedge funds probably have to be a little bit more clever. Back in the day, to be a hedge fund manager, you had to be a rebel. You had to be somebody with a great idea that nobody else had, and you could invest it. Every hedge fund has a recipe a little bit like New Coke for how they make their money. They never really reveal what it is. So now, hedge funds are these big public companies in some cases, and they're completely respectable, and there are a lot more of them. So it's very hard to get that good idea, that new Coke recipe that nobody else has. And I think that we're looking right now at an industry where they have to distinguish themselves.
And let's make one larger point. It's not just rich people in hedge funds anymore. It's pensions funds and all kinds of other things.
That's right. Hedge funds are huge players in the markets, and most regular people never see them and never hear of them. But they're the ones who move money around between the investment banks, pension funds, colleges. They're a big part of this economy.
Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore on the SEC looking into hedge fund returns. Heidi, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, peer pressure as a force for good, not evil.
People who have work and social change need to learn from business because they have been spending years doing things that are not very effective.
But first, yeah, what the heck? Let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials racked up 81 points today, 0.2%, closed at 12,279. The NASDAQ added 26 points, nearly 1%. 2756, the number. The S&P 500 rose 9 points, almost 0.75%, finished at 1319. Advances in the retail and tech sectors helped lift the markets today, which left us with a question. Is Amazon a tech stock or a retail stock? I don't know. You let me know. Whatever it is, shares picked up more than 3% today following the debut of that cloud storage service we mentioned. Google found gains of more than 1% today. IBM computed higher 0.9%. Energy stocks were mixed. Chevron pumped up 1.25%, but ConocoPhillips and Exxon both drilled into negative territory on this Tuesday. Bonds fell. Yields on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.49%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors releases annual data on vacation and investment homes. President Obama talks about energy security at Georgetown University. And a Senate Committee on Energy and Water Development holds a hearing to review nuclear safety in light of the situation in Japan. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The food news out of Japan, the problems with contamination of some of the vegetables near the Daiichi plant, was actually a pretty simple food supply problem to solve. There were only so many possible sources of radiation nearby. But the last time there was a big food supply problem here, E. coli in spinach a couple of years ago, it took more than 2 weeks to figure out where in the production process the contamination happened. In the meantime, hundreds of people got sick, three people died, and spinach growers lost millions of dollars. So afterward, Congress passed a law requiring that stores, growers, and distributors be able to trace every stop between the farm and store shelves. And that, reports Marketplace's Jennifer Collins, has created a whole new kind of business.
We've all played that supermarket guessing game, you know, squeezing, smelling, and eyeballing the food, all in hopes of getting an idea of how fresh it really is. What if you could track that $5 box of raspberries from the field where it was picked to your grocery store cart? Elliot Grant founded a company that tracks meat and produce the way FedEx tracks packages. He says people would be surprised to find out how often food changes hands by the time it reaches the store.
The produce industry is amazingly complex, and the stuff just flies through the supply chain.
Grant created his first tracking system about 5 years ago for pharmaceuticals and semiconductors.
In 2006, when there was that terrible spinach outbreak, we happened to have the right technology, and we quickly realized that our technology was going to solve this problem.
So Grant rolled out HarvestMark. Today it's used by about 2,500 farms in North and South America, and its coded labels can be found on everything from watermelon to chicken, and traced by everyone from the guy in the warehouse to a shopper with an iPhone.
These Driscoll's raspberries, I traced those too back to Oxnard, Mertz Farms in Oxnard, California, actually not far from here at all.
But most produce travels hundreds of miles before it gets to your supermarket. Dan Vache heads up supply chain management at the United Fresh Produce Association. He says new food safety regulations that roll out this year will require point-by-point tracking, even as food changes hands. And that creates an opportunity.
Vendors or solution providers smell a little blood in the water and say, you know what, there is an economy out here we can take advantage of because it's going to be new business.
Vache says Microsoft, IBM, and lots of other companies are trying to get into the market with software and bookkeeping programs. HarvestMark costs about a quarter of a penny for every tracked package. For Driscoll's, remember those raspberries? That adds up to more than $100,000 a year. At a Driscoll's cooling station in Oxnard, dozens of employees all carry hand scanners that they use to record when the berries are unloaded, checked for quality, put into the cooler, and loaded onto the truck for delivery. Operations Supervisor Ray Pena says HarvestMark has transformed what was a color-coded pen and paper system into a high-tech, easily searchable record-keeping operation.
We're faster, we provide better customer service, and you know, data that goes into the system is probably about 90% accurate. I want to say 100, but we're human.
Driscoll's marketing manager, Kim Kolchicki, says the company's investment in the tracking system is nothing compared to what a recall would involve.
If there were to be a quality issue, which of course we try to avoid, but if there is a quality issue, we would absolutely know the process that this berry went through and we could trace all of those steps.
She says that's the kind of knowledge that can keep one bad batch of spinach from bringing down the whole market. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Anheuser-Busch makes beer. A lot of beer. A lot of fizzy, yellow, not all that flavorful beer. The market for that kind of beverage is shrinking, so Anheuser, the parent company of Budweiser, is buying Goose Island, a small craft brewer out of Chicago, parent company of the much lesser-known Honker's Ale. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth how Goose Island and its brews might survive the merger.
Anheuser-Busch produced more than 100 million barrels of beer last year.
Goose Island produced about 127,000.
It's funny. We have an elephant mating with a mouse here. You know, you wonder what kind of babies they're going to have.
Tom Perko runs a beverage industry consulting firm called Bevmark, and he says it's not just the size. They're different species.
It's really difficult to reconcile how you are in that business producing a very large amount of beer with this other sort of boutique-y business, and that you have a clash of values. These are almost two different products.
Craft beers like Goose Island make up a tiny portion of beer sales, but it's one that's actually growing. Overall, beer sales dropped by 1% last year, but craft beer sales were up 11%. Anheuser-Busch says it's planning to keep Goose Island's recipes and brewing processes, just on a larger scale. And it's investing more than $1 million to expand the smaller company's brewery in Chicago. Benj Simon is editor of Beer Marketers Insights, which is a trade publication. He says it shouldn't be too hard to maintain the flavor of the beer, but what might be trickier is something that's more elusive.
It's the identity. It's the unique local identity that they have had. Will they be able to maintain that?
Anheuser-Busch isn't the only one trying to get in on the small beer action. Last year, Miller Coors, the other big brewing company, created a subsidiary to focus on smaller beers. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The demonstrations in the Middle East started in part with young people pushing each other to get out into the streets and call for reforms. That's just one example of what Tina Rosenberg calls the social cure, peer pressure as a force for good. It's also the theme of her new book. It's called Join the Club. Tina Rosenberg, good to talk to you.
Thanks, guys. Nice to be here.
So I hate to take issue with an author right off the bat, but here's the thing. I've got four little kids, and whenever we talk about peer pressure, it's in the negative sense. You know, don't do something just because all your buddies are doing it. But you basically say that in the right circumstances and in the right conditions and with grown-ups, more important, peer pressure can really be a good thing.
Well, I have three kids and I have the same experience. Yeah. But we all know how powerful peer pressure can be and how afraid grown-ups are of peer pressure applied to our children. But we can use this very powerful tool for good ends as well as for bad ends.
Explain that a little bit. I mean, how did you come to this realization?
I came to the realization because I was working on a story about a group of students in Serbia who organized a movement that eventually was key in the overthrow of Slobodan Milosevic. And the techniques they were using were identical to ones that I had seen in a South African government teen AIDS prevention program. And I started to think about, what is it that these two effective programs, which are so different in so many ways, have in common? And the answer was, they try and get people to change their behavior, not by giving them new information about how you get AIDS or how bad Milosevic is, and not by appealing to fear, but by giving them a new peer group to identify with, by making changing their behavior into a really cool and heroic thing to do.
Explain the nuts and bolts of it for me. This group you saw in South Africa, it was the result of a campaign for Sprite, right?
It was modeled on a kind of advertising that Sprite had done, which is called experiential marketing, where you actually try and give people an experience. And Love Life, as the program is known, is doing the same things. I mean, they have after-school clubs and they have school activities, and they actually very rarely talk about AIDS. They decided that the reason that so many South African teenagers had very high risks in their behavior was because they felt alienated, they felt they had no future to live for, so why not just go ahead and live it up now? And by connecting them to other people, by having them be a member of this close group, and by giving them a sense of a more positive future, and by using peers who had been in the same situation and were telling them, here's what I was then, and here's what I am now, and you too can change, they found that this was very effective.
Let me pick up on that point, though, about experiential marketing. What's the difference between concerted and coherent peer pressure, well-organized, and a good marketing campaign?
Not much, actually. Yeah. People who have work in social change, especially public health professionals, need to learn from business because they have been spending years doing things that are not very effective.
Here's another one, not on healthcare at all, but sort of ripped from the headlines. The revolution's in the Middle East. I mean, the people in Tahrir Square giving each other the courage to do what they did.
Well, there's an interesting connection between the revolution in Egypt and the fall of Milosevic, because this group of young Serbians called Otpor, or Resistance, they started to train others. So now they have an organization that goes around the world training dissidents and democracy activists. And among the groups they trained was the April 6th movement in Egypt. And a lot of the tactics you saw in Tahrir Square came directly from the Serbians.
Tina Rosenberg, her most recent book is called Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. Tina, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, Bob Moon told us earlier about getting your music from that cloud in the Amazon story earlier. Well, that gets us to this. There's a company out there called Cloud Girlfriend. Using the tagline, the best way to get a girlfriend is to already have one. The company says it will create a virtual female friend to write sweet nothings on your Facebook wall for you, help you out in the dating world that way, I guess. Two thoughts. One, ew, and two, please. Somebody's going to pay for that? Yeah, they probably will, actually. Anyway, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow racked up 81 points, 2/3%. The NASDAQ added 26 points, nearly 1%. The S&P 500 rose 9 points, almost 3/4%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you can tune tomorrow morning for the latest in business and economic news. Back here next time, tuition discounts only get a school so far, you know.
The net tuition collected by these universities actually fell by 2.5%.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. American Public Media.